You're listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas.
Hey, hey, welcome to The Crossover with me, Joe R. Lucas, brought to you by the Turkish Airlines EuroLeague. Throughout this season, this is where I'll bring you exclusive interviews with your favorite coaches, players, and legends. Each episode, I'll be getting down and dirty with some very special guests as I try to find out what life is like on and off the court for Europe's elite. Make sure to stay tuned in because no subject is out of bounds. Welcome back to The Crossover. I'm Joe R. Lucas, and today I'm able to sit down with one of the most electrifying guards that the EuroLeague has ever seen. The speed, change of pace, ability to rise up over anyone and knock down a pressure shot in a big moment, and especially his ability to get to the basket, use his body and score on guys almost twice his size. If you guessed that I'm sitting down with Anadolu Efes guard Shane Larkin, then you are right. My man, welcome to The Crossover, and thanks for taking the time to be my guest today.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Good, man. You know, the hardest part was me not to call you Barry Larkin, you know?
Yeah, facts.
I'm sure you've heard that a million times.
Millions of times.
I did a game 2 years ago when you were in Basconia, mm-hmm. and I think I called you Barry like two times during the game, and the guy doing
tough.
The game with me said,
it's tough.
Because, you know, I grew up a Cincinnati Reds fan, unbelievably. I was like, I'm your dad's age, so I was more like the big red machine and all those guys.
They were doing the thing.
I know this podcast is about you, but, you know, leave the fact that, you know, I'm jealous of you because of that, man. You got to hang out. I saw you got to hang out with guys that I idolized when I was a kid. What was that like for you, being around guys like, you know, Tony Perez, Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, all these guys?
It was amazing. You know, at the time when you're 5, 6, 7, you don't really understand.
Right.
You don't really get who you're around or what the caliber of these people are. You just see your dad and his teammates. So right. I didn't really know, like, of course I knew they were good players, they're professionals, but I didn't know that they were like Hall of Fame level, some of the best players that ever played a game. So it was cool, you know, seeing how they go about their everyday life and how they go about becoming better players every single day, not taking a day off, and just how they constantly grinded to get to where they were. And it kind of helped me position myself to, when I became of age, to understand that if I want to be successful, if I want to be able to play the game I love for a long time, I got to put that work in the same way. So.
And other than your dad, who was your favorite player on the team when you were, like, hanging around the dugout? Man, just to think that you were hanging on the dugout with these guys killed
you. Yeah, it's kind of crazy that, like, he was a – I'm going to see if you can guess. He played two sports.
Deion.
Yeah, easy.
Yeah,
Deion was just – you know, prime time.
I was watching NFL Network yesterday. Yeah. That's all, man. He never, I mean, he's always putting on a show,
man,
all day long.
In the dugout, always putting on a show.
Was he a better baseball player or a better football player?
He's a better football player.
He's a better football player.
Definitely a better football player.
Because he's electrifying.
Yeah.
And in baseball, you can't really be electrifying. You know, maybe once or twice a game, you get lucky and make a play. But
exactly.
Deion was a man.
He was that guy in football.
Your dad, Hall of Famer, we're going to get into him first and then we'll go on to you. Right. He was a Hall of Famer, one of the best teams ever. As a young kid, I mean, just, again, not only being in the dugout and everything, do you think that it had an influence on you to become the athlete you did? Like you said, when you were 4 or 5, you didn't really know what you were going through. Yeah. But when was the point where you look back and like, damn, these guys know what they're doing. I need to take, not advice, but I seen what they were doing.
I think I was probably around 14, 15, and things started picking up, like, on the recruiting scale. And
basketball-wise? Yeah,
basketball and football. I played football.
Oh, you played football also?
I was a really good football player. I broke my ankle.
What position?
I played all over the field. I was a running back.
In high school, you had to play, high school, you got to play defense, you got to play offense.
Right. I started as a running back, moved to quarterback, and then I ended up like a slot receiver because I was, believe it or not, one of the taller kids growing up. And then, you know, my growth stunned it. But, I played all over the field. But I would say around 14, 15, I kind of really started thinking about, I really love this game. I really love basketball. Right. And I really want to be able to play this for a long time. So I thought back to those days, like, what did I witness? What did I see growing up of these guys that allowed them to be able to provide for their families for the rest of their lives by playing a game?
Right.
And kind of focused me, and I think the number one thing it taught me was, like, the sacrifices you have to make. Like, I'm 14, 15, my friends are starting to do the things that they shouldn't be doing, and I'm right in the same circle. Like, I could do this, or I can step away from that, and I can go play basketball, or I could work on this, or I can go do my homework. Like, I got to have grades to be able to, you know, play the game. Exactly. So I think those are the kind of things that I learned watching those guys make the same type of sacrifice and not being able to spend time with their family, even my own father.
It's hard, like, man. Baseball's
hard. Even being a kid, like, obviously it's great, but, you know, you don't get to see your father as much. You don't get to come home to them all the time because they're on the road for...
It's like, hey, here's my dad. Check him out on TV.
Right, exactly. And you're like, yeah, my dad's Barry Larkin. No, he's not. We never seen you with him. How you going to see me with him? But, you know, it's cool. It's definitely got its positives and negatives, but it was a great experience, and I wouldn't change it for anything.
Did you play baseball? You didn't mention baseball yet.
I played, but it just, like you said, it's not an electrifying sport, and it never really excited me. I played probably until I was 7 or 8. Then, crazy story, I was playing coach pitch, and obviously I'm getting taught how to hit. P-Rose, Tony Perez, these guys are teaching me how to hit. So I'm learning from
Tony Perez became the hitting coach for the Reds also later on. Right? Yeah.
So I'm learning from
Pete. And Pete's the number one. I mean, he's
exactly
what's he got the hit record still. It's amazing.
So I'm learning how to hit from these guys. And 7, 8 years old, I'm good. I'm really good at hitting the ball. And I had like I don't know what you would call it, but I'll pick my foot up and like try to catch a rhythm and try to time the pitcher. And my coach,
the back foot, your right foot, or no, that front foot.
Yeah, my front foot. Yeah. And the coach in the coach pitch, like, since they're throwing you the ball, he would stop me. He'd be like, whatever you're doing, stop. Whoever taught you how to hit didn't know what they're talking about.
But did you tell
them
who
this.
It was?
I'm 8. I'm not going to disrespect you. Know, my father told me the number one thing is respect your coaches. So I'm going to respect my coach. And I'm doing it, and I'm ready to hit. And he's like, stop. Plant your foot and drive through the ball. And I'm trying to do it. I'm not hitting good. So the season going along, I'm not playing well because I'm not hitting the way I learned. And I had to call my dad one day. I told my mom first, I was like, Mom, I don't want to play this sport anymore.
It's not working.
At 7, 8, she's like, what? Like, you don't even really know what's going on.
I'm
yes, I don't really like it. She was like, all right, call your dad and tell him. I was so scared. But I called my dad. I was like, hey, Dad.
So she made you call her.
Yeah, yeah. So I called him. I'm like, yeah, I don't really want to play baseball anymore. And he, at the time, he's just supporting me, just being a cool father. He's like, yeah, it's cool, you know, just take the rest of the season off and, you know.
You'll come back.
Yeah, you'll come to spring training this summer, this spring, and we'll get back into the swing of things. The next season, it'll be fine. Never went back.
Never went back.
Never played another game.
And do you think, I mean, most kids that have famous sport parents, I mean, other than, you know, families like the McCaffrey family, the Manning family, it's not normal that the kid makes it. It's probably about a 25% rate that a kid makes it. Do you think that the fact that you chose a different sport might have made it easier on you? Like, if you did continue to play baseball, you think it would have been more difficult to follow in his footsteps, for example?
Obviously, it's going to be difficult to follow in a Hall of Famer's footsteps.
Right.
So probably, I mean, I was talented. I had all the skills that I needed, so who knows where I could have made it. But being able to have a career like the level of his in that same sport would have been extremely difficult. 19 years, 12 All-Stars, all these things. So it definitely would have been difficult, but I just never had the love for the game. And he never forced me to play, so I kind of just ventured off and did my own thing, fell in love with different sports, and he kind of just supported me with those.
You had an uncle, too, that played basketball, obviously.
Yeah.
Uncle Byron, right?
Yep.
He's the top scorer at Xavier?
Second now.
Oh, who took him over?
David West.
Oh, okay.
David West
took him over.
Yeah.
So was he an influence on you, too, then, when you started to play basketball? Or was he an influence on you before you chose to play basketball?
I mean, growing up, I was always with my uncles because I was born in Cincinnati and they were always around. So I was always playing around with him, and, you know, he was trying to teach me things here and there. And
is your dad originally from Cincinnati?
Yeah.
He was born and raised.
Born and raised in Cincinnati.
Well,
played for the Reds. Yes.
That's crazy.
Cincinnati kid all throughout.
Yeah.
So, my Uncle Byron definitely had a huge influence on me playing the game. And I think me and him kind of related more on that level because me and him had the same love for basketball, whether my dad actually loved football. And then he obviously played baseball.
Oh, so he went to play baseball, okay.
Yeah, he went to Michigan.
Everybody knows football at first, man.
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
It's not a dumb move for people to go to baseball. You do a basketball.
Exactly.
Your longevity, man.
Exactly. But, my uncle definitely had an influence factor on me growing up, and we've remained close now. So.
And you got another uncle that also played baseball.
I have four uncles.
Three uncles.
I have one uncle who played basketball, Uncle Byron. One uncle that played baseball, Steven. And then I have another uncle that played football, Mike. Michael Larkin.
So tell me what like Thanksgiving dinner is like, man, or Christmas is. It's got to be so competitive.
Man.
The conversation's got to be.
The conversations get crazy, and then the games fall out.
Yeah, because everybody knows more than anybody else.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I remember growing up, we would have, like, a turkey bowl.
Right.
Where we play football.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we would play tackle football, like the adults versus the kids. And then we would move on to basketball. Then we'd do some type of baseball
game.
Thanksgiving Day was just like a sports day in my household.
That reminds me of that show Friends. I don't know if you've ever seen Friends, but they used to play that football game every day. The same thing. But y'all got athletes.
Yeah. It got competitive sometimes, definitely.
All right, let's move on to your story now, because, I mean, it's part of your story, but let's talk about your dad. So once you chose basketball, what was it that made you go that way? What was it? It's like, I like this bigger ball better. Is it the excitement of the game, the more movement?
Yeah. It was just basketball. Just was something that allowed me to like explode. Like, I was just a very hyper kid. I like to move. Right. I like to run around. I like to jump and touch stuff as high as I could.
You haven't changed.
Yeah, exactly.
You haven't changed.
Yeah, I just like to move a lot. So that sport kind of just. I liked football too, but football is a lot of. Yeah. Ramming into people, and it was cool for a while, and then people started getting way bigger and start hurting a little more, and then I broke my ankle, and I was like, I'm gonna walk away from this one. But basketball is just a sport where you're always active. It's not a moment on the court where you could just relax. Right. You always have to be active. You always have to be attentive. You always have to be ready to make that next move. And
even when you have that moment, you need to think about your breathing and get your air back.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
There's just so many things that go into it that it just kind of always stuck with me, and the better I got, I just started loving it more and more and more.
Baseball was always my favorite sport, man. Yeah. It was always, when I was a kid growing up, pitching, playing first base, I loved it. But it was, eventually between height and my dad wanted me to go to school and play, and study and all that other stuff. So he was like, no, you're going to school, play. My plan was to go to school, play basketball, then play baseball. But by the time my first season was done, basketball-wise, in college, I was burnt, man. I was like, I can't play baseball now.
Basketball.
Start traveling again?
It's
impossible.
College basketball is a job.
So when did you move to Orlando? From Cincinnati.
Moved to Orlando full time probably when I was like 8.
When you're 8, okay.
Yeah, we would spend summers in Cincinnati, and then I would go to school in Orlando.
Dr. Phillips, right? Dr. Phillips High School.
Yep.
You killed it there. Did you?
Yeah, pretty good.
Did you go in as a varsity right off the bat?
Nah, because that my freshman year playing football, I broke my ankle.
Oh, okay.
That was the reason why I started sticking with basketball.
So you played for Dr. Phillips. You played football for Dr. Phillips High School. Okay,
yeah,
and you broke your ankle.
Fourth game of the season, I broke my ankle. Made me miss basketball tryouts, made me miss all that. And I couldn't play varsity my freshman year. It pissed me off. So I was like, I'm not playing this sport anymore. I know I'm a good basketball player. I want to be a basketball guy. So then I played JV. I started playing halfway through the season, played JV that year, played well on JV. And then the next year I started playing varsity.
Okay, so your junior year you started sophomore year. Okay, so you sat out your freshman year, went your sophomore year, but then you started varsity like during the season of your sophomore year.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, so they saw right away they were moving you up.
Yeah. Yeah, they saw it early.
Senior year, you averaged 18 points, 6 rebounds, 6 assists, all top 30 guard in the nation by scout.com.
And
what kind of attention did you get from colleges? I mean, I know where you went, but who else was size an issue?
Yeah, size was an issue. I guess, I don't know. I felt like I had the whole package. I felt like I could shoot, I could drive, I could pass, I could play defense, I could do it all. But I wasn't tall.
So you didn't have any very big names coming after you?
Nah, not at all. I think my biggest offer was probably, at the time, Florida State. Leonard Hamilton was there. They were ranked. They had a couple good years in a row, and I think that was my biggest offer. I think that was my only offer from a ranked school.
Okay.
But yeah, the other schools like DePaul, Boston College, USF, UCF, Colorado.
So you weren't low, but you weren't high either.
Yeah, I was like mid major to low high major.
Right.
And that pissed me off too.
but that's motivating sometimes.
Yeah, it definitely was motivating, but at the same time.
I always talk about that with people. It's like, you know, you look back on it and you can say it's motivated. At the time, you're like, you know, you don't really know. You're upset that you didn't get picked by other teams. But
and it makes you even more mad when you're like out on the circuit, like the AAU circuit and all the travel ball circuits, and you're killing. Every time you match up with a ranked guy, you're killing him.
Yeah.
At the same time, like, well, at the next level, he's gonna be 6'4" and he's gonna be able to play and da 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 da. And I'm like, I just killed this guy. And literally, we beat them and I killed him. So why? But it was all good, and he ends up going to Carolina. The other guy goes to Duke. Goes to Texas.
That's how it always goes.
Right, and then you're sitting here with like offers from not bad schools. I'm not disrespecting any schools.
No, of course
but
not.
But it's not the level of the schools that they're getting. So,
right. Or the level that you thought you could probably play at. So you decide on DePaul.
Yep.
And I mean, it's a beautiful school, great, just old basketball tradition. At this time, when you decide on it, they're not where they used to be back in the day, but. What moves you away from Orlando, Florida, man? It's a big weather change right there.
Yeah, I just wanted to get away.
Okay.
I mean, my father was always away playing baseball, and, you know, I was always in Orlando. All my friends were in Orlando, and at the time, I was 18, I was just like, I just want to go away and just grow and just become who I want to become without being attached to everybody from back home. Just want to get away and become whoever I'm going to become on my own. And, I went to DePaul, and then some things happened at DePaul.
Did you get there in the summertime? Because I read that you didn't even start the classes. Right. So you went in the summer, typical, let's get some classes in, get some run
with
the players.
Went to summer school,
right.
Was practicing with the team. We were supposed to go on, like, a overseas trip and play against some overseas teams that summer. So we had 10 to 12 practices, I think, where we could practice against the rules because of the overseas trip. And some things start happening back home with my family. Some things start happening with me, and I was just like, all right, this isn't the place for me. So I ended up transferring.
This is the thing that struck me most about this decision is, you know, I went through the whole process that you went through. You know, you get recruited, and the hardest thing, you know, I asked my dad when I was like 16, you know, can you tell them I don't want to go to their school?
Man,
you know?
What?
And so the hardest decision you have to make as a kid that age, and I know your dad would be an athlete. He's like, no, well, you get on the phone and you'd make
me
that call yourself. Yeah.
At odds. Yeah.
So you make that decision, and in no time at all, you decide that, you know, now you're making it even a more difficult decision than you made, because before you had to call 3 or 4 different coaches probably and say, I'm not coming to school, thanks for everything, I'm going to DePaul, I've chose DePaul. And now you're telling the coach at DePaul, you got to go. How difficult was that for you? What were you, 16 at the time? Maybe 17?
Yeah. That was extremely difficult. One of the most difficult phone calls I probably had to make. Just because I always wanted to play for Oliver Purnell. Mm-hmm. He was at Clemson. That's when he had like, what was his name? Dang. One of the Booker brothers. I forgot which Booker brother.
I can't remember. Because I lived in Charleston.
Trevor, the lefty. And they were pressing and they were trapping everybody. They beat Duke. They beat Carolina.
Right.
And I was like, this is a small school that's blowing up. And he gave me an offer. And I was like, I want to come to Clemson. I'm going to come to Clemson. I didn't commit yet, but I told him, I was like, I want to come to Clemson. And then he told me he's taking a job at DePaul. And I was like, well, DePaul is like last in the Big East every year. But he was like, when you come in, we're going to give you the ball, and we're going to turn it around, and we're going to bring DePaul back to what it was before. I was like, all right, cool. So
that's
I went to DePaul.
Just have to say.
Yeah. So then I go to DePaul, and I'm with Coach Purnell, and everything I wanted to happen is happening, but it's not at Clemson. It's a different situation. Right. Things happening. So then, to make that call to him and be like, hey, coach, you know, I know I've been talking to you for the last 4 years. You've been recruiting me since I was a sophomore. But, you know, I'm just going to have to, you know, leave school.
How do you take that?
Surprisingly, he was pretty supportive.
Yeah.
I mean, he obviously encouraged me to come back to school. Everything would work itself out. We're going to build something here, and we want you to be a part of it, and this, that, and the third. But just my heart, like, I was there, but my heart just wasn't, like, my heart wasn't there. And I feel like if I'm going to do something, I need to be 10 toes in. And I just wasn't there. And all the things that were happening just forced me to leave school, and I left.
You've been public about the OCD thing.
Yeah.
And was that part of the issue while you were at DePaul? Now, I mean, it's a difficult disorder, one that's being brought out, you know, more and more publicly as time goes on, which I think is a good thing. But, and I'd like to, if you don't mind, bring some light into the issue a little bit here. A lot of people don't understand it. You know, it's so hard to understand, you know, because you're just like, well, you know, don't do this or don't do that. But it's just not that easy.
Exactly.
You know, people, I've dealt with people that have had that. And it's, if you don't have, it's kind of like alcohol. It's kind of like alcoholism. You know, like if you're not an alcoholic, you can't understand how someone can't give up the bottle. Right. You know what I mean? But this is even more different because it's something internal.
Yeah.
What were some of the issues you had at DePaul? Was it, did it start because you were away from home? This was something you grew up with.
Yeah. I was diagnosed probably when I was 11, 12. I didn't know what was going on. I just knew I had to, I couldn't touch certain things. I had to count certain things. I couldn't step on certain lines. And if I did, I would have to retract all my steps and go back and do the whole thing again. It was just, I didn't know what was going on. I was like, my mom.
But you kind of think that's normal.
Yeah.
When
to me, I'm just like,
that's just the way I do it.
It's something I got to do.
Right.
Yeah. But then my mom started seeing me do things, and she's like, what is going on? And then it started getting, I got to high school or middle school, and it started getting worse. I, like, washed my phone, like, literally put soap on my phone, put it under the faucet.
Come on.
I promise you. I did to a computer, and my mom was like, what are you, like, what is going on? Why are all your phones breaking due to water damage? Like, what is going on? Then I told her. And then she was like, oh, and then she has it as well. So she started.
Oh, she has the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's not like the germ stuff.
Right. But
she's more like a worrier, a checker, anxiety.
I mean, there's so many different things between the germs. I know people who, like, you know, when you open up the refrigerator, you see all the Coca-Cola cans are all the same. Like I said, it's something, but in basketball, it's something that's kind of swept, or I should say in general in sports. I don't want, we're talking basketball, obviously, but it's something that's swept under the rug because it's kind of taboo to talk about.
Yeah.
Was it difficult for you to, first of all, get through it?
Yeah, I mean, when you don't really understand what's going on, it's, and then it starts becoming an issue, then you're kind of like, it puts you at against yourself, like in your own mind. You're like, I know the things that I'm doing, logically, I shouldn't do. Or logically, I don't need to do them. But for whatever reason, if I don't do them, I don't feel like something within me just doesn't feel right. I feel like anxiety. I feel pressure. I feel all these things that I don't want to feel. So I'm just going to do these things. And then by continuously doing those things, it just becomes a habit. Then you start getting these rituals. And then when next thing you know, you're sitting there with me and washing my hands 11 times every single time I touch a chair, or every time I touch the floor, or something like that. So it was definitely difficult.
I love part of the interview you did with Jackie McMullen, I think it was, where you said that, like, I could go out and play basketball, hoop for 3 hours,
go
sit down, have a hamburger, eat a hamburger, but as soon as I got home, I couldn't touch my own faucet.
It was crazy. Like, you died. Like, you can't even explain it or why that made sense to me. I could play, like, I loved football growing up. I could go play football and I can come off the field and eat whatever, a hot dog, and not feel
football,
like I need to wash
my hands.
Well,
football, for example, you're tackling people, you're taking your mouthpiece out of your mouth, you know, it's just...
Yeah, it's just...
But it's like you said, everybody has a certain condition that they're exposed to. When you were diagnosed, did it make it easier for you to understand it, or did it make it more difficult?
It made it easier because I started seeing, like, a therapist, and she started explaining other people who have similar situations and why these things happen or what makes me feel the way I feel. So it definitely helped. But at the same time, I'm like, the worst part about it is, like, I'm a competitive person at the end of the day. So, like, even though this disorder was, like attacking me, I felt like I couldn't beat it. So it was, like, always causing me more anxiety, more stress than I felt like it should. And then when I was 12 or 13, the therapist I was seeing said I should start taking this medicine. And
that was going to be my next question. Because I've had friends and family that had to deal with these things. And of course, in the States, number one thing we do is medicate for everything. You know, if you don't do well in school, you know, you medicate. If you don't do this, you medicate.
Everything.
You know?
Yeah.
But the medication, because I've dealt with it personally with family members, it could possibly change your personality. Yeah. It takes your energy level down.
Yeah.
I mean, your body and mind are not the same. As a normal person, every day, go to school, wake up, study, it's go fine. To work, whatever, it's fine. But for an athlete, you can't, have that effect on your body, your mind, because it slows you down almost.
Exactly.
Did you feel that happened to you when you started to?
Yeah, I took it. Yeah, those first, I probably took it for a couple months, and I was playing travel ball. Highly competitive at a young age, travel ball, one of the highest ranked people. And I just was out on the court, and I just didn't have that step. Yeah, that step. I didn't have that burst, that competitive fire.
Because that comes, like you said, you're pointing to your head while you're talking about it. It becomes, that step comes from your head.
Yeah, exactly.
And if that part of your mind is slowed down, then everything, all the rest slows down with it.
Exactly, because the medicine is supposed to calm everything.
Exactly.
If you're having anxiety about this, then you take the medicine and it relaxes you and you're cold. You're cool. You're cool just being okay.
Right.
And in sports, if you're relaxed and you're just cool being okay, then you're never going to be the best. You're never going to be... You're not going to have that drive to beat whoever this is
mediocre
in front of you.
Mediocre, and it's not an option.
Exactly. So,
talking about it and expressing it keeps you somewhat accountable to it also? Does it make it easier to...
Yeah. I would say in a way it definitely holds... I would say I feel a responsibility now that since I've finally come out and spoken about it that I owe the other people that go through similar things to be able to put it on a bigger platform,
right.
Be able to show them. I can't tell you the amount of calls and messages and
that's great.
Things I got. I posted on Instagram after Jackie posted on the website. My phone probably for the next 6 hours that day was just ringing, text, this, that, third, and everybody.
Because most people didn't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, because once you become so...
You swept it under the rug also.
Yeah, you become so comfortable with it that you find ways to hide it. You find ways to not let anybody see the things you do that aren't normal to other people, that are normal to you. So that day was it was crazy because obviously not everybody had the OCD aspect of it where it was I'm a checker, I'm this, that, and the third. But people would come in I have anxiety or I have claustrophobia and I have this and I have that and I can't. The guy called me, he was bro, after the games, I have to do this every single day after the game. I have to do this. If I don't do this, I feel I'm weird. I can't go to sleep. Right. I can't do this. And I was it's OCD, bro. It doesn't have to be extreme. It doesn't have to be anything. But it can be the smallest of things. But it was amazing to see how many people.
What about superstitions before games? You're walking a fine line because when I used to be the kind of guy that I'd put my right sock on first, my left side, so forth and so on. Superstitions with the condition that you had, you're walking a fine line because you could
extremely.
Easily fall over the other side. Do you have superstitions before the game where
Me? I do not, no.
No, you just go out and play.
Yeah, I mean,
it's better that way for you.
Right.
Just whatever, just go out and play.
Yeah, it's... my dad couldn't step on that...
that white line.
Yeah, he couldn't
most
step on
most baseball players.
Yeah.
I did the same thing.
Like he felt, if he stepped on it, though, he'd have to go back.
And
go
then
back
do it over again. Again?
Yeah, so it's there's a bunch of different ways to look at it.
Right.
You could say this is OCD, you could say this is not OCD, but, I just want to bring a light to it, and if anybody else has, situations or things that they feel weird because, nobody's going to understand me, I did it at a very high level and put it out to the world.
That's the big thing because, it's becoming, the topic is becoming more socially acceptable, as most topics do. Little by little, they become more socially acceptable. But you got guys now like Kevin Love, DeMar DeRozan, that are coming out and talking about these things. And I think it's great because not only are people exposing themselves, but they're also showing people that it's beatable. You know what I mean? It's something that you can get over if you just work at it. And most psychologists will probably say, hey, look, it's not that easy.
Right.
And, I know it's not that easy.
Definitely.
Obviously, it's not that easy. But seeing your idols or the people that you look up to playing basketball or whatever sport on a daily basis has got to be huge for most people. I mean, how many of those phone calls that you got were hey, man, you really helped me out because –
60% of them.
60% of them, because almost like a thank you.
Yeah,
I'm not alone in this.
Exactly.
Because that's how I think people feel alone.
Yeah. You know, and they feel like if they speak about it, then they're weird, or they're people are gonna look at them differently, yeah. or people are gonna not respect me the same way, or whatever. They're gonna look at me in a different light. But
As a society, I think that we have the tendency to internalize everything, anyways. Right. Especially as an athlete, you don't want to show weakness.
Exactly.
You know? One of my favorite commercials back in the day, I don't know if you were too young back then, but I think it was a deodorant commercial, Secret or something. It's like, never let them see you sweat. Mm. That was one of my mottos throughout life. Yeah. I may be not doing good right now, right. but I'm not gonna let you know about it.
Right.
I think that's
right.
the same thing with this issue.
Sure.
How do you deal with it now? Do you just?
I mean, certain things in my life have forced me to not. It's either I was gonna succumb to the OCD or I was gonna power through it, push through it, and be able to play at the level I wanted to play. So now, I still have my things here and there. Like, I still don't turn the faucet off of my hand. I still don't touch the escalators at like malls right. and stuff, because that to me is just like, nah, it's not happening. But
so yours is 100% germ related.
Yeah, then. Mine yeah. is. I mean, when I was younger, I had like checking. Like, I would lock the door, I would leave, and then I'd be like, did I lock the door? I'd go back and check, see that it's locked, walk away again, go back and check again. Like, I had things when I was younger that I had to do, but now it's just specifically germs. And even with the germs thing, there's things that, it's just certain things now. I would say before it was four different topics or right. four different things, and I got rid of a couple of them, and now it's just germs. And even within the germs now, I'm working on things that I don't want them to affect me the way that they do, but I just know there's certain things I'll probably never be able to get over.
Right.
But
you just accept and move on. But that's a lot of people. A lot of people have things they're never going to get over.
Exactly. So I'm not going to sit here and fight anymore.
Some of the things that you have to get over are a lot less than what most people have to get over in life. So you're doing all right. You did. Yeah. I mean, hey, you made it this far. So
right.
Hey, listen, let's move on. I appreciate your openness on the subject, but. Now you end up at Miami University. Mm-hmm. I watched you play a bunch when I was at Charleston, man. You guys had an incredible year. It was Jim Larinaga was your coach. He was originally recruited you from an early age also. He was at George Mason, right? Yep. And then he went to Miami. So did you search him out?
I was at DePaul, and I was thinking about transferring. Then I put my transfer papers in, and I was just kind of like a free agent, as you could say. And I had my AAU coach reach out, and I was like, hey, I know I didn't commit to Jim Larinaga at George Mason. See if they're still interested.
You think he might still like me?
Yeah. So she called him down there, and he was like, yeah, obviously we're still interested. We have one scholarship available. And then kind of just went down there.
That worked out perfect then.
Worked out, yeah. I put in my papers for...
The NCAA thing, did they make you sit out a year?
Nah, because I had to write a letter to the NCAA explaining my whole entire situation about the OCD and about what happened with my mom and all these things. And they granted me the waiver to play in the first year, so I didn't have to sit out.
That's unusual with all the stuff going on now about the NCAA, man. That's right. you don't hear that very often.
Yeah,
so
I was
battles going on.
I remember the day I got the call, I'd start crying.
Really?
Because I thought I had to sit out a year. Like, I thought I wasn't going to be able to play for a whole entire
it's
year.
It's so unfair, man. It's so unfair to make these kids sit out a year.
I don't like the rule at all. But
it's incredibly unfair where a coach can just get up and leave a team.
Right.
Let's say Oliver Purnell recruits you, and then you go to his school,
Clemson, and
before
he leaves.
You get there, he doesn't have to sit out a year.
Right.
It's so unfair to the athlete. But anyway, that's a different subject.
Yeah, for sure.
But you fit into the system right away.
Yeah.
I mean, he brought you in. You started right off the bat. You averaged 31 minutes a game, 14 points, 3 rebounds, 4.5 assists. You guys win the ACC championship your second year. You become the first team other than Duke or North Carolina since 1974 to win the regular season and the tournament, and the ACC tournament.
Yeah.
Lose to Marquette in the Sweet 16, which had to be painful.
Extremely.
It was an unbelievable season. Plus, you're ACC Player of the Year your second year.
Yeah.
I mean,
man, if you would have told me that.
that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Wait, I was like, man, I'm
thinking all this adversity you've had to face up to this point, and you just walk in and do work. I mean, it wasn't like you even took – it didn't take you like 6 months to fit into the program. Man, you just walked in and did work.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of situations in basketball is based on your situation. And I went to a situation where the coach really believed in me, really trusted me. wanted me to play for him at a young age, and he kind of, my freshman year, gave me the ball, and he was like, look, we know the kind of guy you could be aggressive, play your game. I played well my freshman year, and then that second year, I remember we had a guard named Duran Scott, who was like a McDonald's All-American, top level, really high. Probably could have went to the NBA after his second year, but he came back to school, and he was out for something the NCAA said he did. I don't know what it was.
Typical.
Yeah, exactly. And
he probably had dinner with somebody, you know,
exactly.
And someone paid for it.
Right.
It's crazy.
And he was out those first couple of games, and coach was like, well, we need you to take care of the scoring load for both of y'all. And I remember one of the first couple of games I had 30, and that was the first time I had 30 since, like, AAU, but against somebody else, terrible. And I really started seeing, like, yo, I can really do this. And then
is that where that confidence comes in?
Yeah.
It's like, I always remember when that, like, a couple of games was like, shit, I can do this, man. I'm almost better than I thought
yeah,
I was.
Exactly. Then once you get that confidence and you know that your coach is behind you, you can just go out there and play free. And then, you know, I went from 30. Then the ACC started, and then we just started winning and winning and winning. And then LeBron.
That was a fun team to watch. Man, yeah,
LeBron and Dwayne Wade come to the games, and now I'm throwing the ball off the backboard.
Yeah, you had that alley-oop off the backboard. Got him off their feet. That was all over ESPN.
Yeah. So now it's like, that team
get
itself.
Get out my way. Get out my way. It's my world now.
Our team is like, man, we don't care who is in front of us. We don't care where we play, who we play against. What the odds are, we're gonna run through anybody. And we really just had that mentality. And me, myself, you know, I just know from high school, you know, the sacrifices and all the things that happened, breaking my ankle, just all the things. I was like, this is my moment, and if I'm going to take full advantage, this is the time if I'm going to do it. So I went out there, played confident, and my just stock just started to rise and rise and rise and rise, and just ended up having an unbelievable year there.
And that's the year you say, okay, I'm out. I'm going.
You got a strike while it's hot.
Exactly. That's pretty much what I got my question is. Like, you're definitely at the top of your game. I was excelling at University of Miami. But some people would say, no, you're a first rounder. It's an easy decision to get out.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite questions for American guys, and it's usually a question I ask guys that went through 4 years of school, you know, and I remember how difficult it was for me to take off that jersey the last game, you know, and did you know when you lost to Marquette that was your last NCAA game? I mean, you couldn't have been 100% sure at that point.
No, I wasn't at all, but I remember my uncle was at that game, the uncle that played basketball. Mm-hmm. My father was there. I had a bunch of family members there. And after the game, like, soon after the game ended, like, you know, Twitter's going crazy now and all these things. Like, Larkin is out. Larkin says he's leaving. Larkin said that. And I'm sitting there, like, I just lost to Marquette. I'm in the locker room crying with my teammates. We just had this crazy year, and I don't know what the next step is for me. And then after all that, the coach calls me into, like, a meeting room at the hotel in D.C. He's like, we need to talk about next season. Are you going to be here? I'm like, can I grieve with my teammates for 20 minutes before everybody's on me? But I was like, I truly don't know. Like, I don't even know. I'm not looking at draft boards. I'm seeing tweets and this, that, and the third. I don't know where people think I'm going to go in the draft. I don't know who's coming out. I don't know the situation is. Before the season started, I didn't even think the NBA was going to be in my reach this year.
Right.
And everything happened so fast. We went from 25th ranked team to the number one team in the country. All these things have happened so fast. Won the ACC, won the ACC tournament, ACC player of the year, Lute Olson player. Like, all these things are starting to happen, and I'm just kind of sitting there like, I need a second.
What do
like,
I do? I need to talk to somebody.
I need a second to breathe and kind of really see what's going on. And that conversation with the coach was good. He told me, he was honest with me. He told me a lot of teams had been calling and checking on me, seeing what I was going to do. A lot of teams were interested. He actually told me, yeah, you're probably a second rounder, so I don't know if it's the best idea to go.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I feel you. But
you might want to come back one more year, just refine those skills a little bit.
Exactly, but, yeah, it was a crazy year, and after the year, I did my due diligence. I did my research.
Is this where you're no longer Barry's son, and now he's your dad?
I feel like that happened during that season.
During that season,
my freshman year, he would come down to the games, and people were like, Barry Larkin, da da da. We would go in the restaurants, they would ask for his autographs and all that. Then my second year, when I started blowing up and I started becoming like a face in Miami, we would go in the restaurants, people asking me for autographs, and my dad would just kind of walk behind. The best part about it, though, is he was just so happy. Like, he was just so proud. Like, he didn't have any jealousy or he was not egotistical about it. He was just like, man, this is unbelievable. Like, we would sit down after me taking pictures and signing autographs, walking to our table, and then we would sit down. He would just be sitting there smiling. And
that's a proud dad.
Yeah,
man.
My mom would be like, what are you smiling for? He was like, man, that's amazing. Like, to see your son. Like, so it was cool. He was really, really good about it.
I get emotional, man. That would bring, stuff like that bring tears to my eyes, man. Yeah,
for
like,
sure.
I think your dad's about the same age. I'm 53, so your dad's got to be close by. I cry over anything, like the movie or whatever. And I started tearing up. So if I saw something like that, it'd be great.
Yeah, it was dope.
What did you have to do before the draft? Did you have to, like, when you finally decided, did you have to work out for any teams? Did you?
I did. I put my name in for, I don't know what it's called, but you send your name in and you get all the GMs, like, tell you where they think that you're going to end up in the draft. So I got those results back.
Like a questionnaire type
thing? Yeah, basically. Yeah. And I got that results back, and it came back, and I think my range was like 27 to 40. So late first round, early second.
Right.
And, I was thinking, like, do I really want to risk going in the second round, not getting a guaranteed contract? Then do I really leave school? I love Miami. I love where I'm playing. I'm going to take another step next year. Should I actually come back? But talking to my uncle who wanted me to go back to school,
His advice was go back to school.
Yeah, his advice was go back to school. My father was just like, kind of follow your heart. And I remember sitting there by myself because my dad was like, listen, at the end of the day, this is your career. The only person that has to feel comfortable about this decision is you.
Right.
If you want to go back to school, then go back to school. We'll support you. If you want to go.
If you go, go do it right.
Yeah, go. Yeah. Like, go.
Don't be somewhere else in your mind.
Exactly. Yeah. And start thinking, like, should I went back to school? Right. Nah, he's like, if you go, you're gone. Like, no second guesses.
Because then you have the risk of not being there mentally. And,
right.
And now also you're not 27 to 40 anymore. Exactly. You ain't even on the list.
Exactly.
You know?
And at that time, now they have it where you can put your name in the draft. You can go through the whole draft process and then go back to school.
Right.
But back in my days, I sound old.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm supposed to say that.
But back when I was in that situation, if you didn't get drafted, you're a free agent with nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you're trying to get on training camp roster or whatever. But, I ended up putting my name in the draft, signed with an agent.
Did you go through any of those tournaments, the Portsmouth tournament?
Yeah.
No,
I went to the NBA Combine.
Okay, the Combine.
And that's when my stock took another jump. Because people, I guess, didn't know how I was athletic as I was. I jumped the highest and ran the fastest, shot well. And then I went from late second round to middle first round, like late lottery to 25 or whatever. So now it was like my decision was good.
It makes it easier now.
Right. Yeah. Now, based on those results from the combine, I was going to work out for maybe 15 teams, some in the second round, some in the late first. But now my range is higher than that. So now we got rid of all those workouts, and I only worked out for seven teams. I did one individual workout with Dallas, and we went through the draft process. I trained out in L.A., trained in Miami.
Was the draft a dream for you? I mean, I mean, it is for every American kid growing up playing basketball.
That was probably one of the best days of my life,
to be honest. Tell me what you were doing.
I went to the draft.
Oh, you went?
I went up there.
Okay, cool.
I was mad. I'm a competitor. I'm not mad, but I get frustrated. Like, I was frustrated that I didn't get invited to the green room.
Right.
Because I felt like I should have been in there. But I didn't go lottery. I went four after the lottery, so it was cool. But I went to the draft. I went with my family.
I love the competitiveness,
friend.
Man. Yeah, it doesn't matter
what it is.
I mean,
I'm crazy. Something wrong with me.
If you lost like a video game or something,
we playing again. No, we got to play again. If you staying here, we playing again. If not, go home.
I used to say about my kids, I play my kids in video games. I crush them, man, when they're young. I stopped, once they got older and they know how to play better than I did, I stopped playing them. I'm like, if I'm not winning, I'm not playing.
Same as my dad. Same as my pops. Same way. But,
Well, you didn't have to wait that long then. So you're there.
Yeah.
And I mean, this energy, man, must be crazy.
Energy's insane.
But were you? Did you start to get nervous? I mean, to me, You know, when I was drafted, I was drafted like in the fourth round or seven rounds. That's how old I am. Yeah. But to me, it's like 18th is early. But in your mind, you're thinking like,
it was early.
Am I going to get picked?
Yeah, but the teams I worked out for were like, I worked out for Phoenix, who had like, I don't know, top 8 pick. I knew I wasn't going there, but like even when their name comes up, like, oh, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, here it comes. Then I worked out for Philly, who had the 11th pick. Then I worked out for whatever. I forgot who I worked out for now, but I worked out for another team.
Jumping over you, like.
Obviously, you're mad, but you're like, I'm good. You know, they obviously didn't like it. It makes you mad if they take another point guard.
Right, exactly.
You know, Philly took Michael Carter Williams, who's 6'7". Right. I was like, all right, cool. They didn't want a small guard. And then before the draft, my agent was like, yo, I really think you might go to Milwaukee at 15. So I was like chilling until 15. And 15 came, and I was kind of like looking at my phone, checking Twitter, starting to sweat. I'm like, all right, it's about to happen. And at the draft, like, they mess with you because they know who's about to get picked, but they send, like, 4 cameras out to 4 different guys. So pick 11 comes out at Philly, and the camera comes, and it's, like, sitting right in my face. And I'm like, oh, here it comes.
And what do you think? You're thinking, like, what do I do with it?
I'm like, what's about to happen? What was my face? Like, what's about to go on?
Because there's 2 reactions. One when they call you, and one, and the one you can't control is when they don't call you.
Exactly. So they sitting there at Philly with pick number 11, and they're like, the 11th pick, Michael Carter Williams, and I'm just kind of like, I don't know what face to make. Do I make like, this guy sucks, or do I make it, you know? But I know it's my homies, but I'm not gonna make a bad face. Like, I just clap like, hey, good job, Mike. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So it was cool. But
so you go to Atlanta,
yeah,
but traded to Dallas right away.
Yeah,
jumping off the draft thing. I mean, obviously adversity starts right away because you go to the camp and you break your ankle. It's the same ankle you broke when you played football.
Yeah,
same one, no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you go from that extreme high, man. Right. And it's, you know, now that I got the advantage, the opportunity, I should say, to be able to talk to athletes and younger kids, and I always talk about the highs and lows because people think this is all, this is all like, because there's so much pressure on professional athletes that when there is a low, man, it's like lower than anybody's low.
Man,
what was that like for you, man? It's your biggest break of your life right now. You're in Dallas. Personally, I know Rick.
Yeah,
probably not the best program in the world for you to be in the way you play, but you're there. It doesn't matter. And you break your ankle just before summer league. What? I mean,
man,
devastated,
depressed. Like you go from, you know, that day you get drafted, you kind of thinking like, you just kind of reminiscing. You're like, the reason I didn't do these things in high school, the reason I didn't do these things in college was all to get to this moment. Then that moment happens, and you're like the happiest you've ever been in your life. Like, all the sacrifices finally paid off. I'm here, I'm there, I'm about to go live my dream. And you go, you're working out, you're doing your thing. Cuban's watching you, like one of the most exciting owners, I would say, in sports. It's like sitting there hyping you at the practices and like, we're so happy we drafted you. We think you're going to be great here, blah, blah, blah. And then I actually broke it the day we were leaving to Vegas. We had like a little practice before.
So why we need that practice, man?
Man, how many times I asked myself that? Why? Right before, and Cuban actually came down and was standing on the sideline that day. And I was like, all right, this guy had a big factor in drafting me. He obviously had to make the okay. So I'm about to go off for this guy. And I get a steal, playing extremely hard. I get a steal, go on the sideline, keep it in bounds. And then I just go to, like, dunk, and I just, like, snap.
All by yourself? Didn't land on his foot or anything?
There was a big guy behind me, and I was going to go dunk it regardless. I didn't care what he had going on. But I looked at the last moment to check, and I kind of, like, lost my footing, and my ankle. Like, you know, most people twist the ankle like this.
Right.
Mine went inside.
Oh, you went, okay.
Mine went inside.
So you had the crack on the outside, the break on the outside of the ankle.
Nah, it broke inside. So.
Or even broke inside, too.
Broke inside, yeah. That's so it's like a weird, it was like a tragic, like, weird break. And
you start thinking right off the bat, like, will I ever play this game again? I mean, it's not a serious injury, but.
I didn't think that at first because it happened, and then everybody ran over to me. I tried to get up, and I was like, oh, hold on, let me get back down. And then I sat there for, like, another minute and a half, and this goes back to when I played football. My dad said, if you can walk off that field or walk off that court, walk off the court.
Exactly.
Like for my mom, he would say, like, don't let her sit there and think whatever is going on. If you can get off the court, get off the court. So broke my ankle and I walked off. Like, I got up, I walked up the steps to the training table, and then they put ice on it immediately, and they were like, all right, we think it's a sprain, you know. Did you hear a pop? I was like, yeah, I heard a big pop.
So I might knew, just, you knew.
Yeah, I knew. He was like, it might be a ligament, it might be blah, blah, blah. I was like, all right, cool. And I took my, like, if this was my ankle before the ice, after the ice, my ankle looked like this.
Swelled up.
Man, swelled up so crazy. And they were like,
that's not supposed to happen. Nowadays, huh?
Right. I'm like, all right, just wrap it up. We'll check it when we get to Vegas. They're like, nah, you going to the doctor. But then went to the doctor and got the x-rays, and then the doctor, the way he came in, I just knew immediately, like, yeah, it's gone. And I cried for 2 hours just in that room, just like I'm by myself in Dallas. All my dreams about to come true. Right. Oh, they've already come true. I'm about to go play in the NBA Summer League. I used to watch LeBron, KD, Steph Curry, Chris Paul, all these guys playing in Summer League. Now I'm about to go.
It used to be that the Summer League no one wanted to go to the Summer League. Right. Now
it's a spectacle.
Yeah, like, it's just like going out playing with your boys.
Right. So I'm about to go play, be the guy on the team. Like, I just got drafted.
And LeBron remembers me when I threw that ball off the backboard.
Right.
LeBron's my boy.
Right. You feel me? So I'm like, yeah, I'm about to go hoop, but didn't get to go to Vegas that year. And the lows, like you said, the lows of that moment is just like, man, so difficult. You just, every moment you're sitting there, you're just like asking yourself, why me? Like, why did this happen? I did so much to get here. I sacrificed so much. I worked so hard. Why would this happen to me right now in this moment when everything's about to happen?
Yeah.
And it was depressing.
It's part of the challenge.
Yeah.
Does, not to bring up that subject before, but does it give you a scare with the OCD thing again? Because when you're depressed, I mean, your defenses start to go down a little bit.
Definitely.
If there's something else you need to worry, you just don't need to worry about getting back to the court.
Right.
You have to worry about something else that's internal.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, when you have like a positive mindset about the OCD and you're going out and you're fighting the OCD and you're working every day to become better at something, then it's easier to control.
Right.
But
in these situations.
Yeah, in these situations, like, you feel hopeless. Like, I felt hopeless. Like, I had a broken ankle. I can't put any weight on my ankle. I got these crutches.
Right.
I do certain things when I go to the bathroom just so I don't feel dirty. Now it's harder because... So now it's a whole other thing. So, yeah, the OCD in those few months when I was on crutches and dealing with the... accepting of what happened to me, it was difficult. It was extremely difficult.
It's hard. That's just hard for any athlete, man.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I got hurt and I had to sit out. It was like, this ain't me.
Yeah.
I played on anything. Now it's gonna tell me there's something I can't play on.
Right.
It's difficult, man. But so you played 4 seasons in the league altogether with four different teams. If anybody really knows the NBA, of course, I'm not pretending to know it. I played 9 games. You know, I was there for 17. I played 9 before they got rid of me, but I was there anyways.
Right.
It's all about being in the right place at the right time. A lot of players can play in the league.
Exactly.
Do you feel like being on 4 different teams in 4 different years has got to do with the fact that you just haven't found the right system yet for you?
I would say that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, a lot of things have happened. I'm not going to sit here and make any excuse on what my or how my career has gone, but, you know, it's all about the right situation. You know, I could go team for team and tell you the situation that was happening there. But, you know, I just haven't, like you said, I haven't found the right situation for a guy like me to get somewhere and grow with the team. It's hard playing 1 year with one coach or two coaches because the coach gets fired midseason or in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, you guys had.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
coach got fired, crazy. GM got fired. So we were just kind of out there playing
just
without.
Balling.
Yeah, pick up. Like, go do whatever you want to do.
But that was kind of your best year also.
Yeah, exactly.
That was good.
Exactly.
You played the most. And...
Exactly. You're just out there hooping. You're just out there doing what you know what to do.
Right.
So obviously your stats are going to be better. But then after that season, teams looking at like, well, they had no structure. They didn't do this. They had no coach. They had no this.
Yeah,
so
now you got a negative connotation on you.
Right. He hasn't played for a winning team. And when he puts up good numbers, it's for a guy who doesn't put him in a system. So it's been a lot of things that have happened this far in my career, but I'm not a guy that's going to make excuses. I'm just going to continue to work.
Between Brooklyn and Boston, you came over here. As a matter of fact, we're in Spain right now. We talked about Victoria a little bit earlier before the interview. Have you ever been to Europe or Spain anywhere before? Other than just a trip, you know, with a family trip or whatever.
Yeah, just like you said, I went to Italy with my father and family for like 6 days when I was 11, 12. But after that, no, nothing.
So, you know, I always try to imagine this because one of my biggest things is how we as Americans come over here and adapt. And I'm not trying to, you know, make it sound like it was more difficult for me, but back when there was no FaceTime, there was no messages.
Oh,
it was hell back then, man.
Yeah.
It was bad not to be able to see your family for 9 months, you know. But it's still difficult. But here you are, you're drafted in the first round, you played 3 consecutive years in the NBA. Now all of a sudden you're boarding a flight. I'm assuming you boarded, you know, from wherever you left to Madrid, and then you went from Madrid to Victoria. And that's one thing that you and I have in common, the 3 years I spent in Victoria. But what's going through your mind, man, when you're on this plane and you're like, you know, boarding and nervousness, just excitement? Is it, where am I going? What am I doing?
All of those things, I would say. It's kind of like that whole summer was a whirlwind because, you know, I came off my best statistical season in the league. I had my agents telling me, you're going to get this kind of deal from this kind of team in the NBA. You don't have to worry about anything. You're going to be in the NBA making multiple millions this year. After those numbers, that was the summer the salary cap jumped.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the TV contract.
Yeah, the TV contract hit. So Dellavedova signed for $40 million, and this guy signed for $30 million. So my agents are like, all right, you know, Dellavedova was on a championship team. This guy had a better statistical year than you, but they signed for 40 and 30. So we're going to get you something around 12, 15. Just relax and, you know, continue to work, and we'll get it figured out. So I'm just kind of, you know, relaxing. I'm working out. I'm good. I'm healthy.
When they're telling you that.
Yeah, I'm good. And then August 1st hits, and I'm still unsigned. I'm like, what's going on? And, you know, he tells me this, blah, blah, blah. I end up firing him, and I sign with a new guy. And then he's like, what do you think about Europe? I'm like, what? I just averaged 7.5 and 4.5 and 20 minutes. Right. I'm about to go to Europe. Like, what? You got to be kidding me. Dellavedova have worse numbers than me. And he's just signed for $40 million. But he's like, yeah, you know, that's the situation we're in right now. You know, if you go to Europe and you have a good year, there's always a possibility of coming back. But what do you feel? This is the situation. This is the team. This is where it's at. And I'm like, all right, let's do it. I don't have anything else right now. I'm not going to China. I don't want to go to China.
Right, right, right.
You go to China, your chances of going back to the NBA are very slim.
Very
so
difficult, yeah.
European
That's
basketball.
That's end of a career.
Exactly.
Right. The middle of it.
Right, so I'm like, all right, I guess. And
so
then,
on that plane, you have no idea where you're going.
I have no idea.
You're a typical American like I was coming over here. Like,
I'm like, I'm going to Spain. It's about to be beaches. It's about to be hot outside. It's about to be
And I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way because I lived 3 years in Victoria. And I love the place.
Great city.
You lived in Orlando. You went to school in Miami.
Right.
You played in Dallas, New York City, Brooklyn.
Exactly.
Give me don't worry about it. Give me your true, honest thoughts because hopefully I'm going to see you in the Final Four this year there.
So
give me your true, honest thoughts when you first pulled into Victoria.
Well, you know you got – you land in Bilbao.
Okay, so you went – from the States to Madrid, Madrid to Bilbao?
Yeah,
okay.
Landed in Bilbao and then drove.
So you went to that industrial area?
Yeah. I'm like, this ain't nothing what I thought it was about to be. What? What is going on? And then we pull up, and my agent is like, yeah, they got you staying in like a 5-star hotel, and it's got a pool and this, that, and that. It's nice. It's really nice. And like, I'm coming from the NBA, so my idea of a 5-star hotel is one thing.
Right.
Then I get to the Grand Lacqua Hotel in Victoria, and I'm like, it's nice, but it's not 5 stars, you know?
You got the double beds.
Yeah, you got the double beds. I'm like, all right, let me.
I love hearing the story.
Yeah, I'm like, all right, let me really figure what's going out and what's going on. And then I got there like a couple of days early because I was like, I want to get there early so I can go see the city.
Right.
So then, you know, Victoria's not a huge city.
Right. So then, a couple hours.
Right. So I get, they give me a car, and then I'm just kind of driving through the city. And I'm like, all right, this is not New York. This is not Orlando. This is not Miami. It's a nice city.
Beautiful city.
Yeah, greenery.
Right, it's beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah. But it's definitely not what I imagined when I heard Spain. When you hear Spain, you see Barcelona, you see Madrid.
Yeah.
Those are the only two places. In the States, growing up, that's all you really know about Spain.
Right. Of course.
Or Ibiza or something like
it's
that.
It's just like people here, like if I say I'm from Rochester, New York, they're like, oh, New York City?
Exactly.
I'm like, no.
Exactly.
Nowhere near New York City.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was definitely like a culture shock when I got here to Vitoria. And
what was the most difficult thing you had to adapt to? Because, I go back to the fact that it's a little bit easier nowadays because most of the team is done in English.
Right.
Everything's done. When I was here, it was like there's two Americans, and if you didn't speak Spanish, you were lost.
Right.
And they always had someone trying to, you know, translate for you that didn't really know what they were talking about.
Right.
And, you know, I couldn't pick up a phone and, like, FaceTime my mom and, my dad and everything. So you're in one of the best culinary places in the world. Was the food? I mean, because even if you're in the best food place in the world, you know, if you're used to like eating maybe burgers or whatever, it's
at
not
first,
the same.
Yeah, at first the food, I would say food, time difference, and just I would say language barrier. Those are probably just the hardest things. The good thing about my career is I had been moving, like Miami, Chicago, Miami.
Yeah, so you're used to adapting to different.
Dallas, New York, Jersey. Like, I was all over the place, so I hadn't, you know, really found a home yet in my adult life. So, I was used to moving around, and I was used to being in different situations.
It's a big move, this one, though.
Yeah, this one was a lot different, but, I wasn't, like, you can look at it two ways when you're in that situation. You can look at it like, oh, I just had a good year in the league and I'm about to go overseas. I'm going to go into it and I don't really want to be over here. So I'm just going to go into it with a bad attitude. Or you can be like, all right, I should be in the league. I want to be in the league. I'm going to look at this as an opportunity to show what I could do. And I'm going to go out here and I'm going to kill. And I'm going to live this experience to the highest of levels and fully commit myself to the city, to the people, to the fans, and try to learn their culture and see what this is all about. And I feel like that's what I did. And, you know, that year in Vitoria was unbelievable.
Didn't take you much to adapt to the basketball part of it. My agent told me years ago, he's like, your only job is to put the big ball in the orange hoop. That's all it is. You know, that's your big job. You started every game almost 30 minutes a game, 13 points, 5 assists. I mean, there ain't many rookies that show up. And what are you, 24 at the time? 23, going on 24, I think.
Yeah.
There ain't many rookies that put up those kind of numbers in the first year, man. That's, you know, and like you said, you could have showed up with the NBA attitude and whatever, but you went out and did work that first year, man.
Yeah.
This is one thing I like to ask people because I remember I went through it too. How much did you know before you came out? I know you didn't know much about Spain, whatever, about, you know, the Spanish League, the Euro League. And then all of a sudden, like halfway through the season, they throw you in this tournament called the King's Cup.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
I knew nothing.
You didn't know.
I knew nothing.
I was so confused when I first got out of here. Yeah. My first year here, I just played in the Spanish League. And then all of a sudden, we did well enough where we were in some side, a couple of Corets or whatever it was called back then. And all of a sudden, like, we started flying to other cities, you know, other countries to play. I'm just like, and it was like, you know, I'm like, nah, I don't know. I always go play basketball.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
I didn't understand anything, man. It's,
I didn't really.
The EuroLeague's a lot more known now worldwide than
it
was when I played. But, I mean, still, you're out here, like, I got a game on Friday, I got a game on Sunday, and then all of a sudden they throw this tournament, this Copa del Rey thing in the middle of nowhere.
And you have no idea how big of a thing that is either.
Yeah,
like,
it's huge.
That's an event.
Like, yeah,
that
exactly.
That was extremely fun. Like, the Copa del Rey was
amazing.
But
if you don't know it, you're just like, hey, where are we going?
Right. Exactly.
You know, what are we doing this weekend?
That whole year, I was kind of just like along for the ride.
Right.
I was just like.
That's exactly the phrase I was looking for.
I'm just like, all right,
what are
we doing?
Just take me on play.
Right. I just bring my shoes, and I'm like, let's go. So that year was great, though. Like you said, the Copa del Rey was, I had no idea how big of a thing it was. And that year, it was in Vitoria
Yeah. You played at home, that's right.
Right. So we leave in, like, you know, you leave the hotel on a regular game day. There may be a few fans outside of the arena. We pulled up that day for the first game, man.
The
whole parking lot full of fans chanting, singing.
Man,
it was unbelievable. And it gives you like a sense of pride. Like, these people care this much. There's no way we can go out here and lose this game for these people. Like, it was a great time.
The EuroLeague competition, to me, is one of the best.
Yeah.
Because I mean, this is your second year playing. It's 30 games, the mm-hmm. way it's played. And, like, you can't take a night off.
Not at all.
You take one, two nights off during this competition. It's a matter of you being, like, in Baskonia, you're in seventh place
right.
or being in 11th place.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what makes this competition so much fun. You mm-hmm. feel that way, too? Like, when you go out in every game, it's like,
yeah,
man, there's so much pressure.
Yeah, for sure. There's so much pressure on each game because – especially coming from the NBA, you play 82 games. So it's like, all right, if we lose three in a row and then we win five,
right.
we're good.
Exactly.
You lose three in a row in EuroLeague.
No, you're done.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be done. If you lose three in a row in EuroLeague, you have to win five in a
right.
row.
Right, exactly.
There's
exactly.
no other choice.
You can't go back and forth because you need, 16, 17 wins to get in.
I mean, obviously it's a higher level, but it's got that college atmosphere.
Right.
Where every game you go out is just
right.
it's so important. That
and every team can beat you. Like, it's not like,
that's the thing.
You know, in the NBA, there's teams that are purposely trying to lose.
Right.
There's not anything like that in Europe. Like, you just see, like, Madrid just lost last week to,
to
Budućnost.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's crazy. They scored 60 points.
Exactly. Or Budućnost has,
they beat
Cesca. Yeah.
They beat Baskonia.
Exactly.
They beat Madrid at
exactly.
home.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like they have, I don't know, six, seven wins or whatever. But
yeah.
it's like you would never expect
wins.
Looking at the rosters and seeing, like, this team and their budget versus, like, the team of one EuroLeague last year.
It doesn't matter in this one, man.
Yeah,
this
it doesn't matter.
Doesn't
Everybody
matter.
Can play. Everybody's gonna come out and fight every single minute of every single game, and it's really a fun competition.
You were the man in Baskonia, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, you played 30 minutes a game. You were a lot of the team depended on you and your stats and the way mm-hmm. you got people involved in the game too. But then you go back and return to Boston.
Yeah.
Was there a thought of staying? And I know there's a little deal with you in Barcelona and the offer sheet and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
But then what happened? Boston just comes and gives you an offer.
Yeah, I was so excited about Barcelona. I really loved to play. I loved playing over here. I loved the city of Barcelona.
Barcelona's a beautiful city.
Man, I was extremely excited about playing there. I loved Baskonia. I'm not taking anything away from Baskonia.
Are they listening to that over there?
I loved Baskonia. It was a great year. But something about the city of Barcelona, like it reminded me of home. Like, it reminded me of Miami or Orlando, like the weather on the beach. Like, it just reminded me of home. So it spoke to me at a different level. So I was extremely excited. I signed a 2-year deal. I wanted to be there. I was willing to be there for a long time. And then the Tanteo rule in the Spanish league, where you have to do like
right
a buyout.
Right of first refusal, pretty much. Yeah,
right. That whole thing goes on. And there's like a 6-day period where the two teams have to figure that out. And within those 6 days, if a team from somewhere else, a different country, or say another league calls you can sign somewhere else and leave both of that deal on the table. And I think it was like the 5th day, and I get a call from Danny Ainge, and he's like, "What's up, Shane? Really liked your game since college, and really think you would be a good fit here with the Boston Celtics." And I'm kind of looking at the roster. I'm like, all right, you got Isaiah Thomas, you got Marcus Smart, you got Terry Rozier.
That's what I'm looking at.
Why are you calling me? Like, you have three guys that are great players. Like, why are you calling me? I'm not going to just come sit on the bench. I don't want to do that. I want to continue to grow, become a better player. And he's like, Isaiah Thomas, his hip issue is going on. And we really don't know when he's going to be available. Right now, if I had to tell you, we think he's probably going to be available in January. So, from September when we start until January or around All-Star break, you're going to be playing 18, 20 minutes a night if everything goes the way we think it's going to go.
Right.
And I'm sitting there like, all right, I played in Dallas my rookie year. I played some games, but I broke my ankle. I wasn't at full strength. I played in New York my second year with the Knicks. I played in the triangle system, which isn't really best fit for a guy like me.
Right.
Then I played in Brooklyn. I felt like I had a pretty good year. Things didn't work out. I went to Spain for my 4th year. I had a good year in Spain. And now I have this opportunity to go play 18 to 20 minutes a night for a team that's going to be in the playoffs and is going to be a good team with a great coach. And I can really change my reputation as a guy that can't help teams win,
because
I know we're going to win here, and I can help change my reputation while playing a lot of minutes. So I call my agent back, and I'm like, yeah, he wants me to come to Boston. And my agent's like, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity. Isaiah's not going to be there. They say he's not going to come back until February, but who knows if he even plays this year, because his hip is really messed up from the information that we had. Right. And I'm like, all right, well, you know, I really love Barcelona. Are you sure that, that I should do this? And he's like, yeah, man, I think it's a great opportunity for you to go and show your worth and, you know, really start building more respect throughout the league. And I'm like, all right, bet. So we call Baskonia and Barcelona, and we're like, all right, we're going to go to Boston. We go to Boston. 6 days later.
Kyrie says he doesn't want to play with LeBron, right?
Kyrie Irving says, yeah, I want out of Cleveland. I'm sitting there like, there's no way this guy's about to come to Boston. 3 days later, Kyrie Irving headed to the Boston Celtics.
And the rumors were right from the start.
Man, yeah. I'm like, man, here we go. Here goes another.
That's an NBA for you,
yeah,
man.
Here it goes. Business. Yeah, I'm like, I'm on a guaranteed contract. So it's like I can do one of two things. Here I'm insane. I've been in this situation multiple times. I can do one of two things. I can sit here and I can complain and I can say, well, why did y'all bring me here if y'all was going to try to trade for this guy and blah, 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 blah. And I was supposed to play 18 and 20 minutes a night. And now Kyrie's coming. I'm probably not going to play at all. I can do one of two things. I can sit here and do that, or I can just put my nose to the grind, continue to grind, continue to work. And whenever my opportunity does come, because NBA is a long season, it's going to come eventually, and I can be ready for my opportunity. And sure enough, unfortunately, first game of the year, Gordon Hayward goes up.
That was nasty, too.
Yeah, and breaks his ankle. And now we need another guard that can go in certain situations and perform. And then that year, obviously, I didn't play every game. I didn't play the 18 minutes I thought I was going to play, but I had a pretty solid season played in the playoffs, and that was my first year getting burned in the playoffs.
The finals too, right?
Yeah, messed up my shoulder in the playoffs. But you know, it was another great year where I felt like I took a step to become a better player, and it was a great experience.
And then you find out after the season they signed Brad Wanamaker from.
Yeah.
I mean, was that a writing on the wall for you, wasn't it? At that point,
yeah.
I mean, you knew like.
I knew. Yeah, for
and
sure.
That's how you get over here. That's how you come back to.
Yeah.
The interesting thing to me was I understand the decision of going back to the NBA, but you went from, because you were misled, although, because I didn't know that part of it prior. Right. My thought was like, why would he go after playing 30 minutes, wanting to be the man? Why would he go play behind Kyrie? You know what I mean? But now I understand exactly what happened with the situation.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm looking at it like, and it wasn't one of your smartest moves, you know what I mean, to go back to Boston. But the situation.
Before Kyrie was there, the situation was.
Was the right situation.
Was ideal.
Yeah. Do you regret that decision? Because you could have been in Barcelona? I know, like, through this whole interview so far, you've been like, hey, man, I'm here. I got to do it. I got to do it. That's it. You know? You can live on regret, but you got to forget about it.
Right. I wouldn't say I regret it because, you know, coming from the year before, I was playing in the playoffs in Spain. You know, now I'm playing just 15, 16 minutes a night in the NBA playoffs in the conference semifinals against, you know, the 76ers. And that's an opportunity that if you told me after my rookie year when I broke my ankle that this is where I'll be in a few years, I'd be like, hopefully, you know.
Right, exactly.
You know, those are opportunities that many guys play 12-year careers, 13-year careers, and never touch the playoffs, never see the playoffs. But I was playing at a high level with a historic franchise, and those are moments that I'll never forget. So, so part of you is like, well, you know, I could have probably played 30 minutes a night in Barcelona, making more money, playing in a great place where I would have been the man again, and that would have been great. But then I wouldn't have had the opportunity to do these things that I've always dreamed of doing as well. So, you know, I wouldn't say I regret it, but
you take,
you know,
every situation for what it is, and it's just the most out of it.
Exactly.
My biggest thing, because when I played out here, was like I tried to stay with the same team. Now you've been with six teams in six different years.
Man,
I feel, and I think it's been proven over the years, some players get away with it, but playing on so many different, having to adapt to different. You even mentioned it during this interview, having to adapt to different coaches, different situations, different cities, different living conditions, whatever. To me, it seems like you never really get to your full potential. Where if you like sat somewhere for 3 years, is your thought process okay? You know, maybe I want to go back to the NBA, maybe I want to start, but I want to be somewhere where I can maybe sign a 3-year deal now. And cause not that you're getting old, because you're still young, you still got time, but But this goes by quick, man.
Man, that's,
this goes by quick.
I've had, you know, playing, like you said, playing six places in six different years. It definitely, like you said, I don't feel like, the last time I played 2 years in the same place was in college.
Right.
My first year, I was solid.
Right.
And the second year, I was comfortable with
and
the coach.
And that was only 2 years.
Right. Yeah. The second year, I was comfortable with the coach, and I knew exactly what it wanted from me, and I worked the whole summer with them, and I
and
spent a lot of time with them. And then I took off.
Right.
And I feel like in another situation like that, it would be pretty much the same thing. Like, once you become successful, and then your coach trusts in you, and then you could take
that's
that next step.
Not only your coach, but your teammates.
Right. Coach,
teammates too.
Franchise,
yeah.
Supporters, everything. Then,
yeah.
You know, I feel like you could take that next step. So, yeah, I 100% agree with what you're saying. I feel like, you know, it's difficult every single year to adapt and to get to know what the coach wants from you, how he wants to play, what he thinks you can do best for the team at the time.
Yeah.
I feel like all those things go into it. And
well, it's a two-way commitment, too, because
right.
That commitment has to come not only from the
right.
team and the club, but also from you.
Yeah.
They know that, look at, he's, you know, he's
right.
not going to have a good year and pick up and leave the NBA. So.
Exactly.
So my thing is, like, are you going to make a decision to, like, stay here, stay there, go, you know? Not.
I told my agent, I was like, I think after this year, wherever I'm at, I'm going to sign, like, a 2 or 3 year
deal. A longer-term
yeah.
deal.
Yeah.
Good. I think that's right. Personally,
yeah.
I'm not giving
yeah.
you – I'm not wanting
nah.
to give you any advice where you got a Hall of Fame father
been,
back home,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I know how Europe works.
Right.
I mean,
I've
that
been,
helps, man.
I've been feeling that way for a minute, but I think after this year, I definitely feel like I need to get somewhere where I can call – like officially at home,
right?
Like,
exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Like I haven't had
somewhere
at
where you
home.
Can go back to the States, maybe for example, go
right.
back home and know that you
right.
got your house waiting
exactly.
for you when you get there.
Exactly,
you know,
like
that makes a lot of comfort,
yeah,
man.
For sure. And like you know that the team is giving you that we think this is what you can. We want you to be that guy here for this amount of time, and we're gonna ride with you. Your mistakes, your whatever. We think you're gonna be that guy, and we're gonna commit to you.
And build
if you
around
commit
you
with
a
if you commit to us the same way,
right.
Then we can maybe build something here.
I think that mutual decision is huge
yeah.
for a player. And you're at that point right now where I mean, you know, back when I played, it was like between 28 and 30 were those two pivotal
right.
years.
Right
yeah. now, you could maybe 30 because players last a little bit longer
right.
nowadays
yeah.
than we used to, but. But it's a pivotal time for you right now. Let's move on to some personal stuff off the court just to get, you know, and we're going to finish it up. I've had you here longer than I need to.
It's all good.
Hobbies? First of all, he's like, I didn't see anything. No girlfriend, no wife, no fiance, no, no. You just,
man,
you're doing this all by yourself.
Yeah, I'm out here.
You're living the single life.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
You're shaking your head like... You're shaking your head, but you got that wise, that side yeah. smile on your face. Like, I'm loving it, too.
You know, it's hard, you know. I've been six places in 6 years.
Right.
It's hard to find people, friends, girls, you know what I'm saying, people that
right.
you can commit to when you don't know where you're going to be.
Right.
Like right now, if I meet somebody that could be cool, could be a dope person,
right.
I'm going to be gone.
From, be gone
yeah,
right.
I'm going to be gone in a few months. So it's like, what are we really doing?
Right.
So I might as well just keep it light, keep it friendly. And that's just kind of what I've been on with everybody
that
recently.
That smile, man. I don't know. No one can see that smile, but it's telling me things I shouldn't. It's telling me things I don't want to talk about right now. I checked out your Instagram a little bit. I kind of stalked
cool.
you a little bit Instagram. You're all into friends and family and
yeah,
stuff. Like that. That's really cool. And where do you spend your summers? Like when?
Back home in Florida,
Orlando?
Between Orlando and Miami.
Okay.
Yeah.
You got a place in Miami too?
I mean, I haven't bought yet because.
You just don't know.
You can't, you know? But every summer I go back and I rent an apartment or whatever. I'm down in Miami, back at school working out, go home, see my mom. It's a 3-hour drive, so.
She's my next question. Tell me something about your mom, man. See how much of an influence. I mean, a lot of people we talked about already in this interview don't realize what a baseball schedule is like.
Yeah.
It's pretty much your mom's a single mom at one point or another.
She
during
100%
the season.
Is.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, it's 162 games, 81 games on the road.
Yeah.
Your dad was on a team that went to the playoffs, so that's another 15, 20 games on
yeah.
the road. So it's pretty much the whole season being gone.
Mm-hmm.
How much was your mom such a big influence on you without, I mean, obviously, your dad's your dad.
Yeah.
He's the man you look up to and everything else, but he wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, so what was your mom like for you and the importance of her life to you?
My mom is everything, like literally everything to me. You know, my father is who he is. He's a great father, you know,
right.
did the best he could with... the situation that he was given,
right,
you know,
course.
With discipline and all these things, but he also had the responsibility of providing. So he was blessed enough to be able to play a game for his life that he loved and make plenty of money to do it and provide for his family. And, you know, when you're younger, you kind of, like, you're mad. Like I said, I was angry, like, my dad's not home. Why is my dad not home? I want my dad home.
But well, now, think you probably got other kids, their dad's bringing them to school in the morning.
Exactly,
and,
right.
You know.
But now, being in my shoes where I'm at, now I understand. Now I get it. So it's like I understand everything
but
that
I got three kids. That's why I keep telling them, like, someday you're going to understand everything.
And
everything you, I do, you'll get it.
Right. And they're going to be like, nope, you need to be home. You're my father. I want to see you every day. But, you know, I understand it now. But, yeah, my mom, she's literally, like, the backbone of a family. Like, she held it down. My dad was on the road. She would take – and I have two sisters, and we're all – years apart, like my older sister is two years older than me.
What were their? What are their ages?
One's 18 months older than me, and one is 4 years younger than me. So,
so you're the middle kid.
Yeah, so I'm the middle kid. And at one point, my older sister was in high school. I was in middle school. My younger sister was in elementary school.
Oh man!
So my mom would pick up, drop off.
Yeah.
And then I would play basketball.
And you play
my
sports.
Sister would play lacrosse. Like she was like, that's
everywhere.
A full time job.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
She literally worked her behind off, like, to be the best mom that she could be for all of my siblings and me and all my friends. She was just like the mom. Like everybody loved her. Everybody loves her, and she's just one of the greatest people in the world. So
that's awesome, man.
Yeah,
that's
my
awesome.
Mom.
That's
my mom is my everything, man.
You know, I always talk about that with athletes. It's just so hard to you're not home a lot.
Right.
You know, it's hard to be because you're trying to mix that. Because, especially in baseball, you're gone so long that like you know. When I used to come home, be, you know, everybody said it's like a crazy household when you're here because you're not here all the time.
Exactly.
You know, it's like
exactly,
as soon as dad comes home, it's a party, and everybody's like, hey, man, all right.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly,
let's have some fun. And dad doesn't want to come home and be the disciplinarian either.
Right, exactly.
So,
exactly.
And I didn't get anything about one of your sisters, but I did get some stuff about Simba, right? Simba.
Yeah.
Singer?
Yeah.
I mean, look at I told you before, like, I cry at the drop of a hat, man, since I've been in my 40s and 50s, and I got three kids, and I'm emotional, and every time I see them do something, it makes me cry. Every time I see a movie, it makes me cry.
Sure.
The other day, man, I watched her sing the national anthem. Last night, I let my wife watch it, too.
Yeah.
When she sang the national anthem at your father's retirement, the Jersey retirement. Yo, dude, she crushed it.
Yeah.
She crushed it, man.
She's talented.
And I was sitting there, and that's a song that I usually cry to anyways, especially being over here. I mean, I don't cry as much nowadays because I don't believe a lot of stuff that's going on in the States, you know, seeing it from over here, whatever. Well, that's another situation. But when I saw your mom, they like came over to, I think it must have been your dad, obviously your mom, and I don't know if it was your uncle or whoever was there also. And I saw that smile on her face, man. I just started tearing up.
Yeah.
I was like.
Those are very, for even me, like just to see my younger sister, like, get to where she's gotten to and how she strives to be better and how she grinds every day to become a better singer. And she's chasing her dream just like I chased my dream.
She's your older sister or your younger?
Younger.
She's the younger
Yeah, she's
one,
the younger one. So it gives
and she
you.
She goes by Sim Cole, right?
She cut the last part now. It's just Sim.
Oh, just Sim now?
Yeah, just
okay.
Sim. Yeah, yeah.
All right, so what's she gonna be like, Cher and like, you know, like one name?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. Hopefully she can get to that level. So.
Listen. Yeah, I told you, man. I was like, damn, man, this girl's killing it, too.
Yeah.
She actually did an incredible job, man, of singing
did.
It. Because that's a lot of people don't know how tough of a song that singing. And then on top of it, a cappella, man, with no music, no
and
nothing.
Trying to make it your own and all that. Like, it's a tough song.
You're young, not thinking about it now, obviously, but you probably should be, in my advice. But what do you want to do when this is all done? any, like... Yeah, my vision for you is like, you know, helping OCD people.
Yeah.
You know, something like that, you know.
That's something I want to do while I'm playing still, though, you know. Like
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you feel me?
Do like, it while you're still an influence,
right,
cause you know
exactly.
What I mean?
Once you're
don't
done,
wait.
Everybody's like, all right,
I don't
who
say,
is this guy?
Hold on, man, don't say that.
Nah. It's not the same.
Come on, man, we've been here for almost an hour and a half, man. You can't tell me that now.
Nah.
I don't mean nothing anymore.
Not saying that. I'm just saying when you're playing and you're active and people see you going out there and they see you playing every game and every day and they see the athleticism and they see the spectacle. They're like, oh, my God, who is this guy? And then you have more of an influence on it right now as opposed to when you're done and you're like, I used to be this person. I used to play and I used to do this. And they're like, yeah, they still respect everything you did, but you don't have the same platform that you once had. So
I could tell you that I'm in a position now where I get to help a lot of kids and help a lot of people, and it's a great feeling. But you're absolutely right. You're 100% right, because if I would have started that halfway through my career, it wouldn't have taken me so long to get back to where I'm at now.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, that's great. If you're thinking that way, man, go for it. Go do it and help people out. My last question for you, man, and we're done. Let's say I'm a, and I know you're gonna laugh about this again. Let's say I'm a crazy ex-girlfriend. I'm your crazy ex-girlfriend. You in the other room sleeping, going to the bathroom, doing whatever. I grab that cell phone right there that I'm looking at right in front of you. And I start going through your contacts. Give me the most famous person, and I mean, asking you this. This is a big one. Give me the most famous contact I'm gonna find in there. I'm gonna be like, damn, how the hell does he know him?
I don't know.
One that you could send a message to right now, be like, yo, what's going on, Shane?
I don't know. I mean, it's a couple in there, so. The places I've played, I met a lot of people.
Right. Well, give me what you think is most famous. I won't even ask you female. I'll just say most famous. Because I want one man, one female, but I'll let you go on the female one. Come on, LeBron didn't give you his number in Miami?
Nah, I don't got LeBron's number.
No?
Nah, I don't got LeBron's number. I don't know, man. I'll have to look myself. I stick to myself, man.
You know?
I got numbers, but I don't really... I'm not one of those guys that's like, I know you, I want to build a relationship with you because of who you are. Nah, I don't got P-Rose number. Dion number.
Yeah, there you go.
Dion.
There you go then. That's all I'm looking for.
Dion's number.
We'll stick with Dion. No, I don't want his number. I just want to know who you got.
Yeah, I got Dion's number.
Does Pete Rose deserve to be in the Hall of Fame?
Of course.
Good. There you go. Let's end it right there, man. Hey, man, listen. I was kind of a fan of yours before.
Cool.
And now, after this hour and a half, actually, this is the longest interview I've had, man. It's been a pleasure, man. I'm even a bigger fan, man.
Thank you.
The things that you've overcome, the adversity that you've dealt with, is such a platform, like you said before, for other people to like sit back and look back. Use it, my man.
Use it
for what you can use it for. Help other people out, man. It's a great story, and man, I can't be happier to be. I get to commentate the game tomorrow night, so cool. I need you. But your job is to put me at the number one players of the week when I'm doing the game.
I got you.
Shane, man, I appreciate it. Thanks, dude.
No problem. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. If you like what you've heard, subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and leave us a review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You can also get in touch via Twitter and Instagram at EuroLeague using the hashtag ELCrossover or on Facebook at the EuroLeague.